If you'd like to receive this podcast early and without ads, consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Listeners to this show can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience and early access, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, and an invitation to join the DSR Slack community. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code NOJOKE to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code NOJOKE. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, April 6th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent.
In recent weeks, Donald Trump has amplified the claim that the MAGA rioters who violently tried to overthrow democracy are martyrs, victims, and hostages, as he has put it. One of his central campaign promises is to pardon large numbers of them. But who exactly is he talking about? Well, an important new analysis for justsecurity.org offers an answer to that question. It finds that a large percentage of the inmates Trump sometimes refers to are ones who violently attacked law enforcement officers. That's who Trump wants to pardon. This revelation blows apart a lot of the Trump MAGA propaganda about January 6th, and it illustrates clearly that Trump is campaigning on what can only be termed a vow of a lawless second term. Today we're talking to Tom Joslin, the lead author of that analysis and a principal author of the January 6th Committee's final report. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Greg, for having me.
First, let's listen to this audio of a recent Trump rally, courtesy of CNN.
Ladies and gentlemen, please rise for the horribly and unfairly treated January 6th hostages.
You see the spirit from the hostages, and that's what they are, as hostages. They've been treated terribly. Unbelievable patriots, and they were unbelievable patriots and are.
There you go. The January 6th rioters are martyrs, victims, political prisoners, hostages, etc. And Trump has suggested he'd pardon a lot of them if re-elected president. In at least one instance, he referred directly to the January 6th inmates in the DC jail in saying that. So in your study, you looked at 29 people in that jail as of late March, and you found that 27 of them were charged with attacking law enforcement. And of that 27 who had been charged, 19 have either been convicted of that charge or pleaded guilty to it. That right?
You know, that's right, Greg. So what's the important context here is that on March 22nd, Trump posted on Truth Social a flyer, a banner advertising this prayer vigil for the January 6th defendants who are being held in DC. And that flyer referred to them as political prisoners. And we know from another report that came out in the Washington Post that Trump subsequently called Ashley Babbitt's mother. Ashley Babbitt is a woman, a Trump supporter and a QAnon adherent who was shot as she was trying to enter through a broken door into the speaker's lobby on January 6th. And just feet away from her, members of Congress were evacuating, trying to escape Trump's mob. And her mother has become a real principal advocate for a lot of the January 6th defendants, including those held in D.C., and Trump has been communicating with her. And one of the things we learned from the Washington Post after Trump posted this flyer on Truth Social is that, he talks to Ashley Babbitt's mother, and according to her, he says that when he gets in, they'll get out, referring to the defendants held in the D.C. jail.
And that's why you decided to look at who they were.
That's exactly right. These are the specific individuals being held in the DC jail at a time that Trump is saying that these specific people are political prisoners. And according to Ashley Babbitt's mother, saying he would free them. So we know exactly who he's talking about in this case. We looked at 29 defendants who are being held in the DC jail. As you said, 27 of them were charged with assaulting cops. 19 have been convicted at trial or pleaded guilty to that charge already. But what you see in the analysis that we published is sort of a layered approach to looking at them. Beyond that broad top line statistic of understanding who they are. There are a lot of details about who these people are, and they are not martyrs for the cause. They are not innocents who have been locked up. They're certainly not political prisoners who have been locked up purely for their political beliefs. A lot of them expressed right-wing extremist ideas or beliefs, or are known adherents to right-wing extremist groups. A lot of them have expressed, for example, anti-government sentiment, which is now very popular on the MAGA right and a very popular flavor of extremism for Trump's crowd. So, you know, I would encourage people to look at the details of who these people are, these 29 people are, and then match them up with Trump's compare it to Trump's rhetoric, and you can see the difference.
To put a finer point on this, Trump is talking about pardoning a large number of people who were expressly indicted or convicted for the act of violently attacking law enforcement officers. That by itself, I think, wrecks the MAGA line that the January Sixers are victims because they were just engaged in political protest or just acting out their anger at Trump's loss or whatever euphemism you want to pick.
Yeah, you know, and Greg, one of the things that's not in the piece that's I think particularly interesting that I found subsequently was that at least 15 of the 29 defendants that we looked at engaged in the violence at the Lower West Terrace tunnel of the U.S. Capitol. Now, for any of the people out there who have studied the attack on the Capitol, it's well known that this was the scene of some really vicious medieval hand-to-hand combat between officers and Trump's mob. Really, the Department of Justice describes it as the site of some of the most vicious violence on January 6th, and that's certainly true. And you can look at the details of what these defendants allegedly did, in some cases have been convicted of doing, many cases have been convicted of doing, and it's really striking to compare that to this claim that somehow they're innocents or political prisoners who have been locked up for no good reason.
I just want to underscore what you said there. 15 out of this bunch of people in the DC jail, around half, engaged in some of the very worst violence that happened on January 6th. We're talking about in the West Terrace tunnel of the Capitol, cops dug in for hours of grueling hand-to-hand combat with the rioters, with many of the cops sustaining extremely serious injuries, correct?
That's exactly right. You know, one of these defendants who is being held in D.C. currently, and Trump referred to as a political prisoner, is a guy named Daniel Ball. And he is charged with, among other crimes, throwing an explosive device into the tunnel. So all these officers are huddled there. They're, you know, sort of just holding on for dear life, trying to prevent Trump's mob from getting through the tunnel and storming the Capitol once again. And what this Daniel Ball defendant allegedly did was he took an explosive device of some sort, the FBI hasn't even been able to identify it, and threw it into the tunnel, which really concussed a number of different officers who were there. Apparently up to 25 officers were affected by this, according to the DOJ's filings. Several of them, according to a statement of facts filed in this case, lost hearing, at least temporarily, from the explosion. So this is just one example. There are a number of others. I mean, you have another defendant who viciously grabbed at the gas mask that one of the officers was wearing. Some of them used various types of sprays, chemical sprays against officers, used large metal objects and other makeshift weapons to sort of beat at officers. So this is really the opposite of the idea that these are law-abiding citizens who have been locked up as political prisoners. It's quite the opposite.
One other thing that I think you were able to sort of discern in this bunch of defendants and prisoners is that not only did many of them engage in extremely serious violence, the legal proceedings revealed that they were clearly motivated by Trump, were clear Trump supporters, were acting on what they understood as his orders, and were motivated by the lie that the election had been stolen from them.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, I think when it comes to Trump's responsibility for the January 6th attack and for the actions of these specific defendants, there are multiple layers to it. Okay. So it starts with, of course, on December 19th, Trump tweets out, he announces that this January 6th rally is going to occur, and he says, be there, you know, it's going to be wild, something to that effect. And you can see that one of the defendants who goes and attacks cops on January 6th, a Proud Boy associate known as Christopher Quaglin, he says afterwards, you know, the president didn't lie. It was wild, you know. So he's clearly invoking the language that Trump used to announce the rally. And then a number of these defendants, they actually go to Trump's rally at the Ellipse Park south of the White House on January 6th. And at Dilips Park, you know, a lot of them knew it as the Stop the Steal rally. Trump and his people also called it the Save America rally. Regardless, they attend there. And of course, this speech that Trump gives at this rally is probably the most incendiary speech ever delivered by a sitting president. You know, and he says things like, you know, if you don't fight, you're not going to have your country anymore. You know, and I've examined that speech upside down. So there are his defendant, you know, MAGA supporters will say, well, he told people to march peacefully. Well, as you could see in chapter one of the Select Committee's report, the thing that's interesting about the word peacefully is it's totally inconsistent with the rest of the speech, the tone and tenor of the speech. So anyway, they leave that speech and they march down to the Capitol just as he told them. And as they're marching, a number of them, a couple of them at least, believe that Vice President Pence can overturn the election, that he can do something to hand Trump the victory. And they're talking about this, they're even live streaming themselves, walking to the Capitol, talking about this. And one of them gets to the grounds of the Capitol and is calling Mike Pence a traitor because he's learned that, in fact, Pence isn't going to do what Trump wants him to do. Well, where did they get that idea, Greg? We know that they got that from President Trump, right? He's the one who completely targeted his own vice president, including during that January 6th speech, including during his first tweet during the attack. So, you know, what I'm saying is when you go to look at Trump's responsibility for what happened and for the actions of these people, they're certainly responsible for their actions, but he's certainly responsible for inciting them.
And this, to be clear, is who Trump wants to pardon. This is who Trump calls martyrs and victims and political prisoners and hostages. I think one of the missing pieces in this story for a lot of people is the direct link between Trump's weeks-long or even months-long plot to overturn the election, which was procedural corruption of an extraordinary nature, to the violence. What I think a lot of people still don't quite understand is that on January 6th, Trump wielded the mob as a weapon to complete the coup that he had started procedurally and failed to pull off.
That is 100% correct. And you just nailed one of the key points on this. One of the things that I obsessed over when I was drafting the report and helping others write the report for the committee and also trying to express this to the American people is that January 6th is the culmination of his political conspiracy. It's really his last desperate attempt to stay in power. You know, all these other things he did from Election Day, in some cases even before Election Day, through January 6th failed. He tried to pressure state officials. He tried to pressure local officials. He tried to, he had these racist conspiracy theories he spread about, you know, Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman in Georgia, trying to claim that they somehow had committed fraud when that was absolute nonsense. You know, he had all these lies he used as weapons. He willed his weapons to try and get people to overturn the election for him. He had all these lawsuits that failed because they couldn't show any actual fraud. And some of those lawsuits, of course, it's totally legitimate to bring a lawsuit. But after the court has rejected your suit and you can't actually prove your case, you have to move on, right? He refused to do that. In fact, he doubled and tripled down. And then, of course, there's the fake elector scheme, where they have all these fake electors convene and meet on December 14th and cast their ballots. And that was purely about trying to gum up the joint session of Congress on January 6th. They wanted to try and prevent Joe Biden's lawful victory from being certified. And so January 6th becomes the culmination of all this, where Trump desperately tries to get Vice President Mike Pence to do what so many other people wouldn't do for him and overturn the election.
Can you sum up the broader state of the prosecutions right now? How many prosecutions are there ongoing? How many have been convicted? How many cases still outstanding, roughly?
You know, there have been more than 1,300 prosecutions in total. A lot of them have already been adjudicated. You know, I think when you look at a lot of the cases against those who charged who assaulted cops during the attack, those types of felonies, I have sort of noticed an uptick over the last 6 months where more and more of those cases have been brought as the DOJ understands more and more about who these people were that did this. What I would say in the broad scheme of things, this is an enormously complex investigation for the Department of Justice and the FBI to carry out. You know, Donald Trump doesn't want you to know who he's calling political hostages and political prisoners, right? And a lot of these people tried to hide their identities after the fact. And so it's taken a lot of work from, you know, online sedition hunters and the open source community, partnering with law enforcement and others to identify these people and bring them to justice. And you're seeing that more and more.
That gets at something I want to bring up with you, which is that I think people still overlook something fundamental about the position on January 6th held by Trump and many of his propagandists. They're not just trying to spin it away by calling it a political protest or a tourist visit, as one disgusting House Republican put it. They're actually saying January 6th was good, right? Sometimes Republicans who aren't quite in the MAGA mold will say, of course, people who broke the law should be punished, but most of the rally attendees were peaceful. Trump isn't saying that. He's saying the rioters were motivated by a cause that was and is fundamentally just.
This is, to my mind, just as dangerous and just as disturbing as January 6th itself, is how so much of the MAGA right is now really the pro-January 6th party, and Donald Trump is the pro-January 6th candidate. Far from being embarrassed into silence or trying to disclaim responsibility for January 6th, and he's now embracing it. And as you say, embracing these people, these defendants, including these guys who are in these 29 defendants who are in this analysis that we published, he embraces them as patriots. Okay. This is a disfigured patriotism that Donald Trump and his supporters are offering the American people. They have inverted what it means to be a patriot, because, you know, they portray January 6th as a modern 1776, as if it's the second American Revolution. In fact, one of the guys in the 29 defendants I wrote up explicitly talked about it that way, Ryan Nichols. He's somebody who went after, you know, was talking about how Vice President Pence is a traitor and this and that because he didn't overturn the election for Trump. He referred to January 6th as the second American Revolution. And a lot of these people do that, and a lot of people in the MAGA right now are endorsing these January 6ers as that. That tells you that it's a complete inverse, right? They were fighting on behalf of the modern King George. They weren't fighting on behalf of American democracy.
Right. And I think a lot of Republicans probably would have been content to try to inhabit this fuzzy or middle ground where they condemn violence and lawbreaking, but say January 6th was mostly innocent, right? By contrast, Trump is actively martyring the January 6th rioters and creating a historical myth around that day. This is something different. It has elements of fascist politics to it. I mean, it kind of goes to the core of a bigger debate over whether Trump MAGA politics is in some sense fascist or semi-fascist or proto-fascist.
It's certainly authoritarian. So,
yeah, I mean, crucial to what Trump is actually saying is the idea that our justice system is fundamentally illegitimate as it's being applied to both Trump and to his movement, right?
Yeah, I mean, that again, you're hitting at a core point here, a really key point in all this, which is that anti-government extremism, which says that the U.S. government and all of our institutions are corrupt and illegitimate and deserve to be overthrown, that is a central feature of Trump's MAGA platform. It's not a bug. It's not something that just happens by accident. It's essential to his entire political discourse and to how he's portraying himself to the American people. He portrays himself explicitly now as a political dissident opposed to the regime, and uses that type of language and embraces the January 6ers in that context. So what he's saying is that the U.S. government deserves to be overthrown, that these people are in the right to try and do that. This is incredibly dangerous, right? This is so far outside the bounds of normal two-party politics that it can't be discussed in purely political terms. It has to be discussed in terms of the political revolution that Trump and MAGA is trying to achieve here.
I absolutely agree with that. And it's probably worth pinpointing this. Trump is also hinting that he'll pardon the ultimate in insurrectionists, which is Trump himself.
Yeah, I think it's obvious that if he gets elected in November, all these cases go away. And he will make sure that he is legally completely absolved in his own eyes from all this. And he'll shut down. I mean, remember, he would have power over the Department of Justice, and he can shut down, for example, the federal January 6th case. He can shut down the Mar-a-Lago case. He can do a lot to insulate himself from all this. And, you know, what's interesting about that is that if you look at what Trump did in the lead up to January 6th, where he tried to use the Department of Justice for his own corrupt political purposes. He tried to use the DOJ to overturn the election, and what he would do if he was elected again, it sort of turns once again MAGA's claim that the left and Democrats are weaponizing government. It turns it on its head, right? I mean, who here really weaponized the Department of Justice, or at least tried to? It was Donald Trump. He tried to use the Department of Justice explicitly for his own political purposes in early 2021. So, you know, I find a lot of MAGA rhetoric about this type of thing to be a form of projection, and this is an example of that.
Right. I think what you're referring to there is that Trump pressured DOJ officials to create a fake pretext to overturn the election.
Right. And it didn't succeed because the senior DOJ officials who were loyal to Trump and were happy to be in the Trump administration, and lawyers in the White House counsel's office and others, they threatened a mass defection, that basically a mass quit and protest if he named this lower level environmental lawyer named Jeff Clark as acting attorney general, and then had Jeff Clark help him try and overturn the election in Georgia and then six other states. It didn't go through only because, again, there was this threat of mass resignations. But the point is that he was the one who was trying to weaponize the Department of Justice for his own corrupt political purposes.
Do you expect the prosecution for January 6th related crimes to happen before the election?
You know, I don't know. I think it's down to the wire now. You know, I mean, I think it's one of the things that, believe me, when I got off the committee, I watched every day for a hint that an indictment was coming. And every day that went by, I knew that it was going to be harder and harder to get the trial in before the election, which is, I think, crucially important. And, you know, I think Jack Smith did move quickly once he got the appointment and did try to bring charges quickly as he can. I think that his indictment follows the work of the committee very closely in a lot of ways, where we establish sort of the sequence of arguments and the sequence of facts that are relied on in many cases by him and his team. But he's, of course, done his own homework. He's done his own investigation, and they've found things that we didn't know. And he brought the case, I think, probably as quickly as he could. But at that point, it was already late in the game. And now with this silly immunity argument that's being heard by the Supreme Court, you know, this trial has been delayed by a few months unnecessarily.
Can I ask, do you expect any new revelations from Jack Smith, new evidence of something or other involving Trump's plot to overturn democracy? Or to put this another way, what would you like to learn and what do you think we might learn?
You know, I think we'll learn new nuggets at a minimum. At a minimum, we'll learn some new things. Like, for example, you know, we're going to, you know, we know Mike Pence's story to a large extent, but, you know, his handwritten notes he's turned over to Jack Smith's team, which we didn't have, you know. Jack Smith's team came up with this, they found this memo, this December 6, 2020 memo that was authored by Kenneth Chesbrough, who was the chief architect of the fake elector scheme. That memo, I wish I had that when we were putting together the report. It makes it clear in no uncertain terms that this was all about this ridiculous scheme to delay or deny Biden's victory on January 6th. Had nothing to do with any kind of constitutional procedures for electors or anything that was within the bounds of our democracy. You know, Jack Smith's team has also come up with some interesting nuggets. They found that at the TCF Center in Detroit, where this mob went in to try and stop the counting of votes that were being processed there. And this is this very large collection facility in Detroit after, you know, on Election Day and thereafter, that a Trump campaign official played a role in bringing that mob to the facility and riling them up. And this is again, one of these events that prefigures January 6th, right? Trying to use a mob to prevent votes from being counting or prevent our democracy from functioning. So do I expect him to have some more nuggets? I think he probably will. I think he'll have some more facts. But on the other hand, I think we already know the broad strokes of the story. We already know a lot of the details, and I find it damning enough.
It certainly is damning. I hope we get a trial, and I hope we see it through before the election. But at this point, it's looking a little grim. Tom Joselyn, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Folks, don't miss two new pieces up at TNR.com. Timothy Noah on Trump's Truth Social play and why it's already failing, and Kate Aronoff on Mike Johnson's proposed Ukraine deal and why it's cynical and stupid. We'll see you all tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.